Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, Wind River tribal leaders recently proposed the idea of waiving tuition costs for tribal members at UW. They say there's good historical grounds for doing so.
Under the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, this whole southeast corner of Wyoming belonged to the Arapaho.
We'll take a look at how the history of grizzly bear management may hold some lessons for its future.
That we had grizzlies that had expanded their territory or their numbers enough to get down into these river valleys.
And some Wyoming counties are missing out on millions in unpaid tax revenue from mineral companies.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. With grizzly bears off of the endangered species list, many scientists view grizzlies as a success story. But the question remains, how does the bear successfully return to a heavily populated environment? Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska looks at the history of grizzly bear management to possibly learn some lessons for how to handle grizzlies in the future.
On a bright morning in the summer of 2013, Nick Patrick walked his familiar route along his hayfields to irrigate. Patrick was on the ranch that his great-grandparents homesteaded in the late 19th century, 22 miles west of Cody at the South Fork Valley. All of a sudden, he heard his dog crying bloody murder. He rushed around a corner, and his dog was being attacked.
And there was that grizzly sow, and she looked at me from about 25 yards away, and basically said, "You're next." And she was on me in 2.5 seconds. When she came in, I swung and I hit her in the side of the head, but it just, made her madder probably. Bit me full in the face.
The grizzly continued to attack Patrick, but he finally managed to escape. Patrick says grizzly bears were never seen on the property until 1993.
That we had grizzlies that had expanded their territory or their numbers enough to get down into these river valleys, and we then had to learn how to start securing food sources.
Back in the early 70s, conservationists and scientists came together realizing the population of grizzly bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem had dangerously decreased down to a couple hundred bears. By 1975, the bears were officially added to the endangered species list. Mark Brusino used to oversee grizzlies for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. He says one thing they tried to do was protect the bears through education.
We worked with the public to make them aware of proper food storage practices. The land management agencies put in some infrastructures. And all those things contributed to a reduced mortality level that ultimately allowed the population to grow.
And it worked. Throughout the years, the animals' population started creeping up again. This led to the delisting of the bears in 2007. The rule was challenged by a number of conservation groups, and a court reinstated protections in 2010. The conservation groups argued that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had not demonstrated potential impact of the loss of a main food source, white bark pine. Frank Van Manen is the lead scientist of the Interagency Grizzly Study Team, who does independent research on grizzlies. He disputes the fact that white bark pine had much of an impact on the population. In fact, he says it was something else.
It was actually due more to an increasing bear density. And so the idea is that bears were starting to reach carrying capacity within portions of the ecosystem.
What he means is there were too many bears in the area, which also led to increased human and bear conflicts throughout the ecosystem. But another grizzly bear expert, David Mattson, who worked for the U.S. Geological Survey, says they were spreading out in search of food.
And a lot of those high-quality alternative foods are concentrated more towards the periphery of the ecosystem.
Fast forwarding to 2018, the bears have been delisted, and the state of Wyoming is back in charge of managing them. The chief game warden, Brian Nesvik, says the state has more options for management than the federal government did.
We have more ability to provide information to the public. We have more ability to react to conflict situations and deal with them more proactively, I think.
Nezvik says they'll be introducing a phone app and encourage the public to provide feedback on bear management. The next challenge for management is to continue to reduce conflicts between bears and people. Nezvik says it has to come down to keeping bears in regions favorable to grizzlies.
In a lot of those areas outside the DMA, bears just can't be successful. There's too much human occupation. There's too many other human uses.
Like always, not everyone agrees, and the matter has ended back in court. But Wyoming officials believe if they manage grizzlies, the long-term health of the bear will be sustained. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska from the Center of the West in Cody.
The University of Wyoming wants to increase its student body. To do that, the trustees are looking at attracting more out-of-state students by decreasing their tuition. But does that mean the university has exhausted efforts to get more students from Wyoming to enroll? Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson spoke with Rose Martinelli, the senior director with Huron Consulting, who's been working with UW's administration to help the university grow.
UW is the state's only public university, and its stated mission is to offer accessible and affordable higher education of the highest quality. And Rose, how does increasing enrollment relate to that mission?
I think increasing enrollment is about providing more educational opportunities for both citizens of the state, but also from those throughout the region who would benefit from a University of Wyoming education. So it's really inherent to the mission of the institution to teach, to educate, to develop students who will stay in Wyoming to help to be part of the economic development and advancement of the state.
But just because a student attends UW, there's nothing that guarantees that they will stick around to work in Wyoming or contribute to the economy.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, many institutions around the nation are struggling with how to retain great students post-graduation. And so there are some linkages there. One is to make sure we have a wonderful career development opportunity and that there are access to alumni and jobs throughout the state.
And so let's back up. If we're thinking about actually getting students to come to the university and growing enrollment, where are those students going to come from?
Well, it's interesting. A couple things that have happened over the last 8 to 10 years is that we've seen a demographic shift nationwide. The number of students who are graduating from high school has slowed down. It used to grow very rapidly. And then the number of students who are going to college after high school has changed as we've become much more diverse as a society. So I talk about diversity in a few ways. One is diversity in terms of ethnic background. The second type of diversity that I think is really important is also socioeconomic. And then there's this third, which is academic preparation and the types of jobs that students want to have later in their lives and careers. And at one point, our nation was a little bit more homogenous. There were more people who were like educated from like socioeconomic backgrounds, and the propensity to go to college was fairly stable. As we've diversified as a nation, and that's diversity is also rural and urban and so forth, and interests and ability, the propensity of people to go to college is changing. And so the idea of attracting more students to go to college is about raising the profile and the value of a college education. So how do we create a college-going environment and increase the value of college within the state of Wyoming, which is not that populous? And so how might the University of Wyoming begin to draw folks from other areas of the nation, whether that be in Colorado or Nebraska or Texas or California? It's attracting students for whom the University of Wyoming could be a great educational option.
What's your sense of that college-going culture in Wyoming? You know, have we tapped that market, or do those students need more encouragement to come to the university?
Oh, I would say much more encouragement. I think if we look across the state of Wyoming, the propensity of students to go on for a college education is quite low compared to other states. Even the desire to go for a community college degree in Wyoming is lower than the national average.
And what about outreach to populations of people that have been traditionally marginalized from higher education? I'm thinking about first-generation college students. I'm thinking about Latin American immigrants. I'm thinking about Native American students. I looked at some data on the Hathaway Scholarship, for example, and Native students are significantly underrepresented in the numbers of students who receive the Hathaway to come to the University of Wyoming. So I'm wondering, you know, in addition to out-of-state students, what about outreach to those groups? Could that make a significant contribution to increasing the enrollment at UW?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many pockets of population that are underrepresented, and you raise Native Americans. A lot of students for whom college would be a wonderful opportunity think that the constraint of cost would be too expensive for them to actually pursue that degree. And there is a bit of a correlation between economic status and background, socioeconomic. So a person likely from more reduced economic situations oftentimes don't score as highly on standardized tests or don't have access to resources as junior high and high school and primary school where they can advance at the levels that they want. And so we oftentimes give scholarships based on academic merit that don't necessarily help the students who have the most need be able to not only enroll in college, but graduate from college and get a good job. So there are things we need to be shifting in our mind's eye about how we aid and support students from across our great state in affording and finishing their degree. So one of the things that we know is going to be important is that the state needs to invest in a statewide educational information for parents and students about the commitment from the state to provide almost a free education to all students in the state.
And I saw one of the proposals on the table to increase enrollment was to reduce tuition for out-of-state students. And can you talk about how bringing down tuition for out-of-state students would serve the mission of getting those vulnerable populations of students at the university?
It's not an either-or kind of question. It's a both-and. We need to be thinking about our resident population, but we also know that our resident population is somewhat constrained. And while we're seeking to grow that population and make sure that an education for them, whether online or in person, is affordable and viable, we also need to be thinking about how can we reach other students within the region for whom college is just outside their reach. A lot of first-generation students are attracted to the University of Wyoming. So how do we make it affordable not only to come to school, but to graduate from school? And if we are already providing financial aid to some students, that brings down the average cost that a non-resident student or an out-of-state student pays at the university. Shouldn't we just give that price out in order to attract more students to want to be a part of the University of Wyoming communities?
And that's just about having like a clear sticker price.
Tennessee, that's absolutely right. It's just making it very clear without all of the discounts that you have to be schooled in to understand to know. So clear-cut prices can help families who don't come from a college background understand the true costs of an education and can plan more effectively for the whole degree, not just the first year.
Thank you so much. That was Rose Martinelli. She's senior director at the Huron Consulting Group. She's been working with the University of Wyoming to increase their enrollment and retention of students. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Later in the program, we'll take a closer look at reducing tuition for Native American students.
And when we return, a conversation about doctor shortages in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. A study of seven rural states by the Bipartisan Policy Center found that there are challenges to healthcare delivery. One of the states it studied was Wyoming, which has fewer doctors, higher workplace deaths, and problems with substance abuse than other states. Heidi Schultz is the Rural Healthcare Program Officer for the center. She tells me that the doctor shortage is certainly a concern.
In Wyoming, for example, we only have 65 primary care physicians per 100,000 people, and nationwide there's 84 per 100,000. And that's only looking at primary care physicians. When you talk about specialists, it's even less.
So one of the things that people in the state, or at least some of the hospitals in the state, have done is actually one of your recommendations is to look at ways to enhance and improve telemedicine. Do you see that that's going to be something that's going to be critical down the line?
It's got to be. It's definitely a piece of the solution, and it's going to be critical. The Helmsley Trust works with, we have several sites in Wyoming that works with getting rural emergency departments connected with a more urban emergency department so that family practice physician or that PA or NP that's covering the emergency room when a trauma comes in or a cardiac comes in, they can access, you know, a board certified emergency physician who sees you know, dozens of these a day or a week, whereas that rural provider might not have dealt with, you know, this particular instance in a while. And can, you know, via live video, assist that provider and the nursing staff to help that patient. So it's so important, not just for patient care, but so that the providers don't feel so isolated and alone. You know, they were trained in teams. They were trained in bigger urban settings, and they aren't used to being the sole provider, everything to everyone.
Well, and so I'm kind of working backwards on your recommendations, but that's another one that you've got is providing some more support for primary care physicians. Wyoming is part of the WAMI program where they bring in students that have to spend 3 years here. I think that happens, but they can't wait to get the heck out of Dodge because they are getting overwhelmed in some of these smaller towns.
Right, and we need to figure out a way to provide more support to them and more peer support in teamwork. And like you said, the telemedicine might be an important piece of that. We also need to be able to provide more residencies. So you're talking med school, which is great, and the WAMI program is so important to our states of Wyoming and Montana, which don't have medical schools, which I will tell you blows people's minds from the coast. they don't understand that. But WAMI is such an important role, and we need to take it a step further and provide more residency opportunities for those physicians when they're done with med school. Once they're in a residency, statistics show that many physicians will practice where they serve their residency. So we need to find a way to provide more rural residencies. And while they're in those residency training opportunities, to provide them support. So like you said, they don't feel so alone and overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. So you were also talking about funding mechanisms for rural areas. I know our legislature certainly has found this to be a very expensive venture trying to do things locally. Are you talking about a federal solution?
Probably a federal solution and maybe some state issues. And some may just be tweaks in regulations from CMS. The real issue is that everything is so siloed. And to just serve a patient and bill for their services, you know, it could be a private insurance. It could be a combination of insurance and private pay. It could be Medicaid. It could be Medicare. And there's rules and regulations to all of those ways of billing and providing services. And it's so separated and siloed. And we've got to figure out a way, you know, how do we serve this patient and how do we pay, you know, to make sure we can pay for this and have the service available without being so difficult and regulated and really siloed. I hate to use that word too often, but it truly is. When you talk to providers, they want to provide the best care possible, but it's very complicated.
The Wyoming statistics also show that the state saw excessive drinking for adults increased by 14% in the past year. And in the last 10 years, drug deaths in Wyoming increased by 67%. Heidi Schultz is the Rural Healthcare Program Officer for the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Now that the government's lights are turned back on after last weekend's three-day shutdown, Wyoming's lawmakers are joining a growing chorus of Republicans calling for change to how Congress conducts its day-to-day business. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from the nation's capital on the growing calls to overhaul the Senate's long-standing filibuster rule.
Let's start with last weekend's brief government shutdown. Lawmakers on both sides of the political divide are breathing sighs of relief that they were able to seemingly save face and pass a bill to fund the government for a mere 3 weeks. Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi is chair of the Budget Committee. While he utterly disagrees with the tactics employed, he understands the dynamics at play.
Well, it's unfortunate that it happened. And it's one way that the minority has some potential leverage, but I think everybody has to agree that it's bad leverage and shouldn't be done. And I said that before the shutdown. I've said it since the shutdown. They really don't serve any purpose. Now, there's always some fiddling to save face, but that's all that ever comes out of them.
The temporary shutdown of the government has renewed, even emboldened, Enzi's repeated calls to move Congress from having to pass annual spending bills to splitting the duty into a two-year chore. He wants Congress to debate and pass the six most controversial spending bills the year after an election, and then to take up the other spending bills the following year, when every House member and one-third of the Senate have to face voters at the ballot box. Enzi is exploring ways to make government shutdowns more painful for people here in Washington.
But there has to be some consequence for us not finishing up by October 1st. And it has to be a consequence that doesn't just affect senators, doesn't just affect the agencies out there. It has to affect every staff member as well, if we want to have progress.
Enzi seems to have a trick up his sleeve for his evolving plan to inflict that pain. But that doesn't mean he's going to let us in on the plan.
I'm inventing it, not saying.
Enzi does support efforts to streamline how the Senate works, though, especially because Democrats have been slow-walking President Trump's nominees.
We need to do something because the ones as of 2 weeks ago that had not been confirmed yet, at the rate we were going, would take 9 years. And the president isn't going to be in office for 9 years. Everyone can guarantee that.
But just tweaking the Senate filibuster rules for nominees isn't good enough for many House Republicans, like Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney. She's among a growing chorus of House lawmakers who are pressuring the Senate to drop the current 60-vote filibuster threshold for other items, like on the spending bill that just led to the partial government shutdown.
I think we have to have a fundamentally changed system because of the Senate. And when you are in a situation, you know, just in the debate just now on the floor, we're in the situation where it takes 60 votes in the Senate. And when the Senate refuses to pass appropriations bills, I think they need to probably adopt a nuclear option for appropriations bills.
When Cheney says nuclear option, she's saying to do the same thing Democrats said and eventually did under former President Obama, which was to blow up longstanding Senate precedent and lower the threshold to a majority of votes needed to confirm judges. Cheney wants that extended to military funding.
At a minimum, I think they should look at doing that for the defense appropriations bill. I mean, if you're willing to do it for the confirmation of Supreme Court justice and other judges, which is, I think, the right move, when it comes to security of the nation, we really are in a situation where the system allows the Democrats to hold funding for the Defense Department hostage because they want amnesty for illegal immigrants.
Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul says small states like his and Wyoming need the filibuster to protect them from an activist Congress.
You know, I think there's been more bad laws promoted than good laws in our history of our country. And so the filibuster actually stops a lot of dramatic changes in government, you know, that can be sometimes bad. So I'm not really for changing the filibuster for legislation.
And the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, is also dubious of lowering the filibuster threshold on spending bills.
It would make the Senate, for all practical purposes, just like the House of Representatives, and it would make the majority party ability to ignore the minority party, and the minority party would be cut out of the process. And you would have more erratic legislation and less moderation.
Still, Wyoming's junior Senator John Barrasso disagrees with more senior Republicans like Grassley and says change is needed in the upper chamber in order to make the government move more smoothly.
Well, it's something I've supported throughout. Changed the rules, voted to do that on the Supreme Court justice, and ready to do it now on the number of hours that it takes to get to a nominee as part of the Democrat obstruction of trying to get the president's nominees in place, and on getting to the spending bills that come out of committee and overwhelming support, I think it's important to do that as well, to get them to the floor of the Senate and then passed.
Many Democrats who voted to change the filibuster rules in the Senate under President Obama now regret their knee-jerk reaction to gridlock, because it's left them largely defenseless to combat what they see as President Trump's most egregious nominees. Still, many rank-and-file Republicans are pushing their party leaders to make a similar move, even as they risk losing their majorities in November. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Coming up, tribal leaders propose waiving tuition for Native students at UW, and we'll hear from the head of diversity and inclusion for the U.S. Olympic Committee. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. As we heard earlier in the program, the University of Wyoming is working hard to increase out-of-state enrollment. But what about in-state? When UW President Lori Nichols was hired, she set a goal of reversing a seriously declining enrollment of Native American students at the university. To do that, she opened a Native American Center and hired a Native American program advisor to make the campus more welcoming. And it worked. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, now there is not enough money to fund all the interested students applying.
Northern Arapaho Chairman Roy Brown is a busy guy these days. From his car, he talks about how fast his tribe is growing. 10,300 members strong. After generations of hardship and high mortality rates, that's good news. And he says 40% of those members are kids.
About 4,000 of our members are under the age of 18, are going to be looking at opportunities for post-secondary education.
Brown says education has always been valuable to the tribe. That's why back in the late 80s, the tribe had the vision to establish a $1 million endowment that is now appreciated to $2.25 million. Usually, each year, a handful of students are eligible for endowment scholarships.
This school year, we actually had 14 students that qualified for this endowment scholarship, which is two or three times more than we typically see.
He says that prompted the Northern Arapaho Business Council to start brainstorming how they could adequately fund all those students to attend UW.
One of the ways that we're exploring is starting a dialogue with the Board of Trustees to get a tuition waiver for our tribal members.
A tribal tuition waiver is not a novel idea. Eastern Shoshone member James Trosper is the director of the new Native American Education, Research, and Cultural Center that opened last fall on the UW campus. He says lots of states already offer tuition waivers or discounts for tribal members.
Fort Lewis is probably the most notable. There are several other colleges in Colorado that also do something similar. CSU has an agreement. Montana is another state.
Michigan, North Dakota, Maine, Idaho. Trosper says these states often offer them as a way to acknowledge broken treaty agreements. Trosper says the same should go for the University of Wyoming.
Most of the universities have agreements with tribes who had previously owned the land where those universities are now built. And this is a good example of an agreement that could be made because this land where the University of Wyoming sits once belonged to the Arapaho.
In fact, Trosper says the entire southeast corner of Wyoming was originally granted to the Northern Arapaho in the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851. In mid-January, Trosper and Northern Arapaho Chairman Roy Brown and others made this argument to the UW Board of Trustees. Eventually, they'll be the body in charge of making the decision. In a Laramie Boomerang article, Trustee President John McPherson was quoted saying, "This is a kind of a slippery slope, because if we do it for your tribe, then do we have to do it for the other tribe?" End quote. He went on to point out that then other organizations might argue for a waiver too.
I'm in agreement that it could be a slippery slope, but I think that it's really important that the trustees consider that it's going to be a very short slope, because there are only two tribes that are citizens of Wyoming, and that's the Northern Arapaho and the Eastern Shoshone.
Honestly, I have mixed emotions about it.
That's UW President Lori Nichols.
I mean, on one level, I would love to do it, because I would love tribal members from Wyoming to feel like they have access to a higher education and that finances are not a barrier for them.
But Nichols says when she was hired, her first priority was funding cuts, $19 million from the university's budget. And that was just to make ends meet after a severe downturn in the energy industry.
Part of what we've really not done yet is really a financial analysis, is just to take a look at how many tribal members do we have attending the university, and if we gave some kind of a waiver or discount, what would be the financial impact of that, and could we handle it?
Northern Arapaho Chairman Roy Brown says currently there are 11 Arapaho students at UW, but 10 times as many attending other colleges, some in Wyoming, but many in other states. He says the tribe would like to think of UW as its home school.
The tribe as a whole recognizes the value of education in just about every aspect of how we want to reach our goals in providing for a safer, more robust, economically developed community for all of our tribal members.
And as Wyoming struggles to convince younger generations to stay and help grow a robust economy statewide, the 4,000 Northern Arapaho youth considering where to go to college might just be a great place to start. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Jason Thompson is the head of diversity and inclusion on the U.S. Olympic Committee. But back in the 90s, before he was running diversity initiatives for the Olympic Committee, he was the first Black president of ASUW at the University of Wyoming. Now, he's returning to his alma mater as the keynote speaker of UW's MLK Days of Dialogue. He told me that being student body president wasn't exactly one of his ambitions.
You know, it's funny because I didn't want to be president. I had no intentions of ever running to be student body president. I did it more so because Dominic Martinez, who was the vice president when I was president, wanted to run. People were kind of giving him a hard time about it, and my wife just came with the idea I should just run with him just to be supportive, and that's what I did. So I was always a little surprised about how I was treated. And some of it was negative, some was positive. I mean, it was a lot more negative than I thought it was going to be. I'm glad I did it. I think it's been a pretty significant piece of my life and my personal history. I learned a lot, to say the least.
What were some of those reactions that you were talking about, some of those negative and positive reactions?
I didn't really know what to get myself into. And so I just did your typical stuff. You know, I just made these posters. I put them up. And I kid you not, they were being ripped down faster than I could put them up. And I remember people telling me, Jason, you're never going to win. I would say, well, why not? They would say, well, you don't have any posters up. And I would say, what are you talking about? I got posters everywhere. And sure enough, they were literally being ripped down as fast as I could put them up. And then I remember one night at home, I got a phone call, and somebody was literally threatening to beat me up. That was early on, within the first couple of days. It got to the point that it got so heated, they actually, to run the general election, they actually brought in the city of Laramie, and they used all their equipment, and they actually conducted the vote, because there was a lot of tension even between myself and some people who were running and conducting the election. And so to make sure that didn't become an issue, the city actually ran the thing. I think that's the only time that's ever happened.
Do you think race was the motivating factor behind some of those reactions?
You know, part of it was I was kind of an outsider, I guess you could say, so some of it might have been that. ASUW had always been kind of the same small group of people typically running and winning, and that's just kind of how it was. And I think some of it was race. I can't deny the reality of that, and it's the world we live in.
How did that experience impact your decision to continue working in diversity and inclusion?
I would say when I first left, I was a little disappointed. It was a rough year. I mean, there's a lot of little slights that we had to take, and I say we, me, myself, and Dominic. So there's probably a little bit of bitterness I left with, but I'm over that. You know, now I look back on it, it was, you know, you have a choice to focus on good or bad things. And I think generally there were some really good people there that helped me along the way that didn't have to, who felt very committed that this was important, and specifically the trustees at the time. And I remember being very nervous about going to the trustee meeting thinking, you know, if the students are treating me this way, I can't imagine what's going to happen when I get to the trustee meeting. You know, it's all these older white people who, and I had all these assumptions about them, none of which ended up being true. They're very nice to me, and it was a great experience. And I think maybe the reason I continue to work in diversity is partly because of that, because it was a positive.
You have gone on to work with several different organizations, academic institutions. How did you come into your current role at the U.S. Olympic Committee?
I'm lucky. You know, it's a funny story because I had forgotten I'd even applied for the job, and I got a phone call, and I was not one of the top candidates. They basically said, we got an interview today if you want it. And my first response was, well, I definitely want it because I love the Olympics. I want to be a part of it, but it doesn't seem fair because everyone else has time to prepare, and I hadn't had time to prepare. And so she said, well, it doesn't matter. It's about you, and they want to know more about you. And basically, if you don't take it, you know, we're just filling the slot. So it didn't give me the impression they were all that interested in me. But for whatever reason, I must have done a good job because I got the job, and within about 2 weeks after that first call, I had received an offer to work for the Olympics.
Well, it seemed to have worked out. What all do you do in your role?
So a lot of the work is looking at what are our processes as far as, you know, how do we recruit and make sure that our staff is diverse. And then we also work with all the national governing bodies and encourage them to do things in the area of diversity. You know, my CEO came to me and said, hey, you know, how are we going to measure diversity? What does this mean? And so we actually developed some scorecards. You can go to our website and see them. But I think what we've done is we've made it transparent. We've said, you know, we're committed to having a team that looks like America. And not only that, we're going to be honest about where we're at and the places we need to do more work. Because in some cases, we need to see more women in coaching. In some cases, we just don't have a very diverse fan base, or we don't have a very diverse team in that particular sport. Because that's really what it's about. It's not that everybody has to be an athlete. It's just that we think everybody should feel like this is something they should be able to participate in as a fan. We're excited about the Winter Games. It'll probably be one of the more diverse teams that we've ever taken to a Winter Games.
You will be returning to your alma mater, UW, for the MLK Days of Dialogue, and you're going to be the keynote speaker for that. What was it like to be asked to speak?
I'm honored to be asked and probably intimidated, to say the least. You know, the more I think about it, the more I got nervous about, I'm not sure what to say. But then, you know, as I started to reminisce, I started watching some videos and different things, and there's something that struck me. You know, you can always watch these videos from the 60s, and there's a moment where these young African-Americans are just sitting at a counter and people start to beat them. And I thought all they were asking for was to sit at a table and to be served. And I thought, you know what, there isn't actually that much pressure because they were just fighting for me to be average. And if you think about it, that's not that big deal. You know, that's a non-issue. You should just, you know, why can't I just go get a meal? And so that has actually helped me to realize that I don't have to be Martin Luther King when I give my comments. I just have to be average, and in an odd sort of way, that's all they were fighting for.
The year's theme for MLK Days of Dialogue is reflecting on progress, so taking that look back as you have as well. What progress do you think still needs to be made on civil rights?
It's one of the things, too, I think sometimes when people point that out, people feel like, oh, we're not validating the past. And I think it's part of the process that we should continue to question. I think that's the work we need to do. You know, I look at this Me Too campaign, and to me, that is success as much as it is failure, in the sense that it means people who have felt in the past they could not speak up now feel like they can speak up. The work is moving forward. I think those also represent very difficult, uncomfortable conversations that we need now continue to have. Why, you know, we see almost no women or no people of color as CEOs, that we haven't fully opened the door to all the opportunities in our country. And, you know, some of those answers are going to make us uncomfortable.
Jason Thompson is the Director of Diversity and Inclusion on the United States Olympic Committee and the keynote speaker for the University of Wyoming's MLK Days of Dialogue. Jason Thompson, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. I definitely appreciate the time.
Thompson will be speaking Thursday, February 1st at 7:30 p.m. in the Union Ballroom as part of the MLK Days of Dialogue.
When we come back, stories on Wyoming's latest effort to regulate edible marijuana and how counties are missing out on millions in unpaid tax revenue for mineral companies. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. 4 years ago, a judge ruled that Wyoming's drug laws only deal with plant forms of marijuana, which means that people with large amounts of edible marijuana could not face felony charges. Law enforcement agencies have asked the legislature to address the matter, but it's been a tough battle. As Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports, neither side has been willing to budge.
Wyoming's drug laws don't take into account popular edible and drinkable forms of marijuana. Wyoming makes 3 ounces of leafy marijuana a felony. But when lawmakers tried to make 3 ounces of edible marijuana a felony, there was outrage. State Representative Charles Pelkey.
You know, we can talk about the minutiae of this topic, but the fundamental problem is whether or not you want to charge someone as a felon for bringing a 16-ounce THC-laden drink back into the state of Wyoming.
For those of you wondering, tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, is responsible for marijuana's psychological effects. It's what gives you a high. The problem is that some forms of edible marijuana have a lot of THC and some don't. All forms of edible marijuana have other ingredients such as butter, oil, and sugar. Maka Kalagi is the director of sales and marketing for Organic Alternatives, which is a place where you can purchase pot in Fort Collins, Colorado. In some ways, it looks like a candy store with chocolate and gummy bears laced with THC. There's also a wide variety of traditional forms of cannabis. He says 3 ounces of pot that you smoke is a lot.
It would absolutely take me at least 3 months, if not 6 months, to finish 3 ounces of cannabis.
Which is why it's a felony in Wyoming, because it's assumed that much marijuana will be sold. But it wouldn't take Kalai 6 months to finish a pot brownie. The Wyoming legislature will consider 2 bills this session, and neither takes it easy on edibles. One would make 3 ounces of edible marijuana and 36 ounces of liquid marijuana a felony, while the other bill would make 3 ounces a felony but lessen penalties for first and second offenders. The tough stance is because law enforcement sees dangers with edibles. John Nepper of the Wyoming Attorney General's office says people often eat more than the recommended serving.
You know, I think one of the things that the edible marijuana industry has taught us is that if you want to sell a psychoactive substance, a really effective way is to bundle it with chocolate, because that's something people like.
Ben Peach from the Converse County Sheriff's Office says people try to downplay edible marijuana, especially in small amounts, but he says it can be very dangerous.
When they strip it of all the trichomes and use the commercial process to get that THC and THCA out of it, they may only have a very small amount of oil, but it's extremely potent.
Laramie defense attorney Cole Sherrard fears countless felony charges over small amounts of marijuana. Wyoming State Crime Lab says it can't measure for THC, and THC levels on labels is hearsay and inadmissible in court. But Sherrard says they need to figure it out.
I think there's enough literature and research out there where you can at least get some idea of how much are in these edible products and try to compare those to our current statutes and try to come up with something a little more fair.
Sherrard says the fear is that there will be an increase in felony charges, which he says is serious business.
You know, having a felony conviction, you lose firearms, you have trouble getting into schools, you're pretty much out of the job market for all intents and purposes. So, yeah, it's certainly tricky.
Representative Pelkey says the legislature has wasted too much time on the issue and thinks they should move to decriminalize Wyoming's marijuana laws.
You know, I haven't spent this much time listening to people pointlessly talking about weed since I was in high school.
The full legislature will once again consider the issue next month. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Counties are losing out on funds owed to them every year. This is money that helps pay for road maintenance, police, and education, among other services. That money is supposed to come from mineral companies, but the system intended to collect those taxes is complicated, slow, and makes it easy for companies to pay late or not at all. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
When you look past the courthouse in downtown Pinedale, there are rolling hills dotted with sagebrush and thin, dark shapes. Those are oil and gas rigs. They're the largest contributor to revenue out here, but sometimes when those companies remove resources from the ground, they don't pay a key tax to the county. In the years 2006 to 2016, Sublette County has missed out on over $300,000 in tax revenue from mineral companies. County Clerk Mary Lankford explains why that loss is important.
We're dependent on that money to run our shop, run our, you know, all of our different departments, our law enforcement, our jail, the whole bit, and the money doesn't come. Here we are, we've committed the money, we've budgeted the money, and the payments don't get made, so we're short of money.
The tax that's being missed is called ad valorem, a one-time tax paid to counties when a resource is removed from the ground. In Sublette County, ad valorem taxes account for 90% of the budget. A large percentage of that funds schools. The problem with these tax payments going unpaid is systematic. Legally, a company has up to 18 months to pay the tax, leaving plenty of time for things to go wrong, from bankruptcies to selling off assets to simply deciding not to pay. Lankford says Sublette County has to blindly put together its budget without knowing when or how much mineral companies will be paying back in taxes.
That's a nerve-wracking situation because we then have to have a contingency. We have to have a reserve out here to say, okay, what happens if these payments don't get made? Do we have a budget reserve account that we can backfill for those payments that don't get made?
Counties can also miss out on funds because they're not first priority in debt collections when there is a bankruptcy. In fact, right now, Sublette County is fighting with a Texas company over around $4 million the company says they don't need to pay. Lankford says all of these issues become a little bit worse when the budget is tight. Other counties also have this problem. A recent report from the Powder River Basin Resource Council calculates that $42 million are owed to 12 counties in Wyoming in delinquent mineral taxes. The report analyzed the numbers from 2006 to 2016. Hesed Brandow, one of the authors of the report, says this problem can force counties to restructure and even cut services during bust times. She says it's a serious issue.
Because this is where we get our money for not only schools, but trash collection, road maintenance. Cities use this money in all kinds of ways, and we also use it at a state level for our education system.
Brandow explains, unpaid ad valorem taxes also impact school funding. Around 40% of the school foundation's budget comes from property tax revenue, which is mainly from mineral taxes. Any loss can hurt when the state school system is seeing a deficit of over $600 million from the 2016-2017 biennium. Right now, the huge shortfall in mineral tax revenue comes in a big part from the 2015 and 16 market downturn. Here's Brandow again.
This problem isn't going to go away without reform because there will continue to be busts. There will continue to be companies that owe 18-plus months of back taxes.
In the report, Brandow explains there are many simple legislative solutions that could cut back on tax delinquency to counties.
Counties could change collection to a monthly instead of annual collection schedule. If liens were automatically attached to mineral production taxes, counties would be moved up in bankruptcy proceedings. If counties had access to a funding pool at the state level that they could draw from in order to pay for representation in bankruptcy, basically the key is in legislation.
House Revenue Committee Chairman Mike Madden says counties shouldn't be left hanging when companies decide not to pay.
We should not have to rely on counties to go out and be our bill collectors for us. We should at least participate in somewhat of a proportion of what kind of a benefit we would get from those collections that would be well received by county governments, especially smaller counties that aren't, they're not wealthy. Some of them are kind of living hand to mouth.
Reform options are clear to Madden. While the county collects ad valorem taxes every 18 months, it's every month for the state, and the state has significantly lower delinquency rates.
Which tells me that obviously part of the problem, or if not the majority of the problem, is that we don't synchronize and have property taxes due at the same time that severance taxes are due.
There was legislation in 2016 that would fix the problem, but it came during the market downturn, so energy companies helped defeat the bill. Madden says the issue is not scheduled to be discussed this year, but it could again in 2019. An effort that would help counties in the bankruptcy process has been drafted for this session. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear an individual segment, you can go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
There you can also sign up for our podcast, listen to old segments, and link to other WPR content. Anna Rader is our web editor.
You can find all of our reporters on Twitter. I'm under the name Butter Bob. You can also find our stories and station information on our Facebook page.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.